Hello, and welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections podcast, Lockup Lowdown. The goal of this podcast is to provide listeners with information pertaining to all aspects of corrections, one issue or one topic at a time. I'm your host, DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. Today we will talk about the DOC's Violence Reduction Initiative, and joining us today is SCI Forest Superintendent Derek Oberlander. Thank you for joining us, Superintendent. Before we get started, Superintendent Oberlander, would you please provide our listeners with a brief background of your corrections employment history?
Yes, good morning, Sue. I started with the Department of Corrections in 2004 at SCI Forest as an electronic trades instructor. And prior to starting with the department, I had worked for an engineering firm. And the firm that I was employed with actually got hired by the Department of General Services to serve as the construction manager for SCI Forest. So I was on site at SCI Forest on September 17, 2001, and was here for the duration of the construction project, and left the project in 2003 and was assigned on a ATF project and an IRS Level 5 security upgrade project in Martinsburg, West Virginia. The facility had sat empty for several months, waiting for it to be activated, and Superintendent Sabina was on site in 2004, and they were preparing to activate the facility, and there was some remaining issues that needed to be addressed, and the firm that I was working for asked me to come back up on site and help assist the facility in getting things activated. I met Superintendent Sabina, and he encouraged me to go take my civil service test for electronic trades instructor, and he indicated there'd be some openings coming up for that, and they would need someone that understood the systems here. So I did that. I'm from Clarion, Pennsylvania, and my wife and I are raising our kids in Clarion, and it was an opportunity to be at home and come and work for the department. So I was excited about that, and I joined the department in 2004. In 2005, I was promoted to a Corrections Facility Maintenance Manager 1. And then in 2009, I was promoted to a Corrections Facility Maintenance Manager 3. Always had great mentors while working for the department who encouraged me to seek out opportunities. And one of the things that I had always discussed is, as far as career development, what I needed to do to continue to advance in my career. And some of the suggestions were that I needed to possibly consider looking maybe at getting out of the maintenance department and going into another department. In 2011, I was presented with an opportunity to go to the Pennsylvania Board of Probation Parole as a parole agent, and I accepted that opportunity and was there. And in August of 2013, I was named the acting supervisor at the Franklin sub-office out of the Mercer District. And I think it was October 2014, SCI Forest had an opening for deputy superintendent, and I applied for the position and interviewed, and then in February of 2014, I was appointed to as DSCS for centralized services here at SCI Forest. So from February 2014 until April 2016, I served as the Deputy Superintendent of Centralized Services, and then I was moved over to the Deputy Superintendent of Facility Management, and I served in that capacity for a little over 2 years. And then in August of 2018, I moved back to Deputy Superintendent of Centralized Services, and on March 23rd, I was promoted to superintendent of 2019.
Phew, wow, that's very impressive. I'll tell you, so you started as in the electronics area, and you've had so many different jobs, you know pretty much all there is now to running a facility. I mean, really running a facility, from a facility maintenance management aspect to, you know, administrative management aspect. So I think that's really exciting and very interesting. So thanks for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
So let's get to the nitty-gritty of the Violence Reduction Initiative. Several years ago, knowing that our accrediting organization, the American Correctional Association, was going to change their national standards for restricted housing, our Secretary of Corrections, John Wetzel, gathered hundreds of DOC employees from across the system to tackle this issue. He wanted to be ahead of the change and find ways to change restricted housing and reduce its use, also while reducing violence within our institutions. And this initiative actually started sometime in 2015 or 2016, and since then committees have continuously been working to develop new procedures, But also from the very beginning and even before this statewide initiative, your facility was greatly involved in efforts to reduce violence in your own facilities. So tell me how you specifically and SCI Forest have been working to reduce violence. How did it all get started and where are we today?
For us at SCI Forest, our violence reduction strategy began in August of 2014, and our planning and research and statistics department does a great job of giving us data to make evidence-informed decisions. And if you look at the scan reports back in 2014, from May 2014 through August, you'll see that our assaults and our fights were just going off the chart. And it came to a tipping point on a Saturday in August, which it was Saturday, August 23rd. It was also the day of our statewide volunteer banquet. And we had an inmate in our general population stab two of our officers. And we locked the facility down. And Secretary Wetzel was actually at the statewide banquet when this occurred and had commented that we needed to really work to get the violence reduced at our facility. We had our command post activated and we came back. And I know on Sunday, we were sitting in the command post and Superintendent Overmeyer said that we've got to come up with a committee and look at ways that we can reduce violence. And it literally started in the command post with a Google search for violence reduction strategies for correctional facilities. And we came across a promising strategy that Washington State Department of Corrections implemented in 2011 that was based on focused deterrence principles. And I'll circle back and explain those principles here in a minute. But we reached out to Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla is where they started this strategy in 2011. And they put us in contact with Carly Kuchip, who is a program director at the time, and she was phenomenal. She sent us their procedure, their policy. She sent us their two-year report, which showed that by implementing their strategy, they were able to reduce the violence at their facility by 50%.
Wow.
So we formed a committee that Monday. We formed a committee, and we had our first meeting, our violence reduction committee meeting, on August 29, 2014. And one of the things that Secretary Wetzel always emphasizes that we need to do a truly bottom-up approaches to get the staff who are doing this stuff every day to give us the input that we need. So it wasn't us sitting in the command post telling staff what we were going to do. It was we brought truly a bottom-up approach. It was every job classification in the institution, regardless of your rank, you were invited to come and participate as a member of the committee. So we formed a truly multidisciplinary committee, and we reviewed the data and the policy and procedure that Washington State had sent to us, and we drafted a procedure, and we had that finalized, I think, in October, around the 10th of October in 2014, and Superintendent Overmeyer at the time submitted that draft to Central Office for approval, and we got tentative approval to go ahead with a pilot and implement that on December 19th of 2014. So, to explain the strategy a little bit, it's based on focused deterrence principles. And focused deterrence principles deter violent behavior by reaching out directly to offending groups and individuals with the specific message that violence will no longer be tolerated. And if it continues to occur, that it's going to be met with a credible threat of sanctions that are swift and certain. And also you have to provide a credible promise of help to those that want it. And that is known as pulling every lever. And the focused deterrence principles originated in Boston in the mid-90s with a community policing strategy that was developed by David Kennedy, who was a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government at the time, out of necessity. The Boston had experienced in the late 80s and early 90s a 263% increase in their youth homicide rate.
Oh, my.
And it was directly related to gun violence and youth homicides and drug activity between gangs and groups. So David Kennedy worked with the Boston Police Department, community leaders, religious groups, advocacy groups, prosecutors, public defenders, and they came up with the focused deterrence principles to go in and enforce swift sanctions for continued acts of violence and at the same time truly offer a credible promise of help to the community for those that want it, and they saw a 63% decrease in the youth homicide rate after it was implemented.
Wow. So this is really impressive. It looks like you took the information that you obtained from the Washington DOC, Walla Walla officials, and also the Boston individuals, and put it all together, tailored it to a program, a violence reduction program specific for your institution.
That's correct, Sue. And again, Operation Ceasefire, what became known as the Boston Miracle in the mid-90s, is exactly what Washington State utilized in 2011 when they saw they have a similar demographic at their institution that we have at SCI Force. They have a high concentration of SDG inmates in their facility and a high violence rate. And they actually contacted David Kennedy, who pioneered Ceasefire in Boston in the mid-90s, and he helped them develop the procedure that became known as Operation Place Safety in Washington State. And they sent us all that information, and we incorporated that into our local procedure, our pilot draft that we submitted in October 2014.
Tell me about the makeup again of your inmate population at the time that this was starting. Now, I know you used the term STG, and so for our listeners, I'd like to explain that that is security threat groups or gangs, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you had a high population of gang members?
Correct. At the time, we had over 200 inmates that were validated as security threat group members, and we were tracking another 160 inmates for gang affiliation. So we had a high concentration of security threat group inmates at the facility, and again, our violence, a lot of it was directly related to group and gang related issues at the facility back in 2014.
So in addition to the procedures that you're going to go into more detail about, has the DOC reduced your number of STG inmates at your facility now?
We do have. Currently, we have a little bit less validated security threat group members, but we're still tracking almost 300 total with the inmates that we have validated here.
Okay, so now explain how you got both the staff and the inmates to buy into this program.
That's a great question, because that's one of the only reasons that it's working. So what you find, and what the same thing that ceasefire initiatives are being implemented all the way across in several states across the United States and cities right now, and they're seeing a 30-70% reduction in gun violence and homicides as a result of it.
So, can I just interrupt you here for a second? For our listeners, what is ceasefire?
Ceasefire is a community-based policing strategy that is the what our model is based after. So David Kennedy took the ceasefire model that originated in Boston in the mid-90s, and now he is the director of the National Network for Safe Communities. And they go in cities across the United States, and they implement the ceasefire model, which the focused deterrence principles that were used in the mid-90s have now became known as a group violence intervention strategy.
Okay.
They're applying those in cities across the United States, and they're seeing great results. So
okay,
we're implementing the same thing. So the buy-in from staff and inmates, initially when we formed our committee, we were able to get buy-in from staff because we had the data from Washington State. They sent us their two-year report that showed that by implementing the focused deterrence principles to stop the violence, to reduce the violence, that they were able to reduce it by 50%. And each year, we've provided our staff to our violence reduction committee, and we have call-ins with the inmates, which is a key component of this strategy, which is notification. You have to notify, in order to deter that violent behavior, you have to notify individuals of what you're going to do, and the call-in is where that takes place. And it's the same in the community. So when they go out and they go to implement a ceasefire model, they conduct a call-in with the community, and it's not only the local police departments, it's the advocacy groups, it's the prosecutors, public defenders, everybody working together with the community to reduce violence. And that's the same thing we see here, because we have, this is a community here. You have social networks with the inmate population, and those networks can influence or discourage the violence. So the goal is to communicate that message to them that we're not going to tolerate the violence, and if it continues to happen, our procedure is swift and certain that here's what will happen if they continue to engage in those violent acts, serious violent acts.
Can you give us some specific examples of an act and how you would respond with a specific swift and certain sanction?
Yes. So ceasefire models typically focus on homicides and gun violence in the community. In a correctional institution, you're focusing on the most serious offenses, your staff assaults, your multi-inmate fights where there's three or more inmates involved in the fight, and an inmate-on-inmate fight or assault where weapons either used or displayed. And again, those are known as prohibited violent acts. And that's we took that directly from Washington State's procedure, and we've coined those same acts as prohibited violent acts. So we go to our inmate population at our call-in, and we explain to them what the prohibited violent acts are, and that if one of those prohibited violent acts is committed, we will immediately lock down the unit where the perpetrator of that act resides for 36 hours.
Oh, even if the act didn't take place on that unit?
Correct.
Oh.
So if the act, for example, if it takes place up in a dining hall, if that inmate is housed on a general population unit, A unit, for example, at our facility, and the pod, our units are split into two pods, that pod will be locked down for 36 hours.
So is the thinking there that the community of inmates within that pod will kind of play a role in also disciplining the key players in the act?
Not in disciplining, but again, if it was a group related, and during that 36-hour lockdown period, our committee and our security office is working to determine whether or not it was a group related event. So not only focusing on security threat group inmates, but we may have inmates from Philadelphia who resided on a particular street together and associate with each other because of their street address. So they're not necessarily a validated gang member, but they have a group affiliation because of where they reside, where they came from.
Right, but certainly if I was an inmate in a housing unit that was locked down because Joe Jones was involved in a three-inmate incident, and I wasn't involved at all, and I'm locked down for how long, I kind of add pressure to those individuals, be like, hey, cool, not cool. You made me lose my visits. You made me, stuck in my cell. So I think that you also have that kind of a component that helps drive the success of your program. Would you agree?
I would agree. And what we see on the front end of it is that what we weren't seeing before, to give you a good example, is we have a line that goes directly to our security office. So before, if something was getting ready to happen, typically you might not hear anything until after the event happened. Well, now we get tips that something's going to happen because they don't want to get locked down for that 36 hours. So our security office, our intelligence captain and lieutenant are getting real-time intelligence that something may happen because they don't want that. For example, they might provide information that this inmate in A unit has a weapon and may be looking to assault someone. So then we can go in and seize the contraband and prevent that from happening. The other thing that we see is we've seen where, because one of the prohibited violent acts is a multi-inmate fight where three or more are involved, we see two inmates that'll start to fight, and then we see a third go to step in, and other inmates will actually stop the third inmate from stepping in because they know as long as it's one-on-one and there's no weapon involved, while those inmates will get sanctioned with the misconduct, the whole unit's not going to get locked down. Hmm. But that's an example of it deterring the most serious of violent offenses.
So how is this different from prior to when this was started?
Prior to this violence reduction strategy being implemented, when we had one of those prohibited violent acts occur, we'd lock the entire institution down.
Oh.
So to circle back to your question about buy-in from staff and inmates, the inmates now see, too, that we're not locking the entire institution down. We're focusing specifically on where just the perpetrator lived.
Okay. Well, that would make sense. I mean, and I was trying to kind of look at it from a parenting kind of standpoint, right? So if you have three children and one does something bad, you discipline the one child. Maybe it's grounding them to their room or whatever, and not the others if they weren't involved.
Right. And again, the other part of the buy-in is that we're typically, when those events occur like that, you don't right away know what the circumstance is. So until we have a time for our intelligence captain, lieutenant to decipher what actually caused the event, one of the things we see is the greatest predictor of violence was the preceding violent act. So they have an opportunity, and we tell the inmates that this gives us an opportunity to figure out exactly what happened and make sure there isn't something further that's going to happen that would put them at risk also.
Wow. Interesting. Earlier when you were talking, you mentioned the use of data and you mentioned scan report. And I know that our listeners are not going to understand what that is. So I'm just going to tell them that our Planning, Research, and Statistics Division, they collect data on everything that's going on in our institutions so that our administrators can look at the data and determine, is something about to happen? Is there a trend that we need to keep our eye on? So I just wanted to explain what that's what SCAN is without going into many details. The other thing I really wanted to ask you about data is, how have you changed the way you collect and interpret data based on this new violence reduction initiative?
Since we've been implementing our violence reduction strategy since 2015, we've been collecting data on all the perpetrators of our prohibited violent acts. And we're looking at everything from the inmate's age, whether or not they have a security threat group, whether they're validated, whether they have violent history, whether they have a history of drug or alcohol use since they've been incarcerated, whether they're what their med compliance is, if they're a mental health stability C roster inmate. We're also looking at their aggression score, their time to their first misconduct, whether or not they have a current violent offense, and what their initial custody level was at classification. And working with Dr. Buckland and the Planning, Research, and Statistics Division, we found that there was a connection between the AG score, their aggression score, their time to their first misconduct, whether or not they have a current violent offense, and whether or not they have an initial custody level classification of 4 or higher being good indicators of a predictor of violence. And we're using that for a assessment tool with our program review committee. So any inmates that are put into restricted housing for, say, a violent misconduct, a fight, assault, a drug-related misconduct, a weapons-related misconduct, we look at that data, and if they score 3 or higher on our program review committee risk need review, then we place them on our step-down unit. And the reason for that is that our step-down unit is part of the focused deterrence to give them also a cognitive behavioral component where they're required each week to attend a cognitive behavioral group that's often making informed decisions about change, the MIDAC platform. So one of the things that we saw in looking at data is there was a meta review that was conducted on the most successful things at reducing community violence, and the two things were focused deterrence principles and cognitive behavioral therapy. And the inmates that we see that we're releasing from restricted housing back to general population to successfully reintegrate them to general population typically are not a priority placement for groups because they're not within 2 years of their minimum. So this way they're getting a weekly cognitive group requirement to progress through the phases of the step down unit as we work to reintegrate them back into general population. And we've seen a lot of success with that. So that's one way we're using the data. The other way that we're using the data is we map out all of our prohibited violent acts at the institution, and we've worked with our line staff. For example, we typically feed in 3 inmate dining halls, and based on a high number of prohibited violent acts occurring in one of the dining halls where the two sides of our institution kind of come together during our times when we're running our main lines, we were able to get their input, and we reduced feeding down to 2 dining halls and separated it out, and we reduced the number of prohibited violent acts from 9 in 2016 to 1 last year occurring in our dining halls. So again, that's another way that we're using the data that we're collecting to track and see whether or not it's working. And one of the most important things about the data is to measure whether or not this strategy has been successful. So those are the types of things that we're using the data for.
Wow, very interesting. I did think of one thing while you were talking was, okay, so you had this initial call-in with the inmates, but your population changes. People get released, you get new admissions into your institution. So do you have regular call-ins, or is that part of the inmate orientation process for your institution? I mean, certainly you have to make everyone aware of, here are the rules, here are the things we're not going to accept, and here's how we're going to respond to those.
Yes, and that what we do is, again, we do have reoccurring call-ins, but every inmate at our inmate reception committee, when they're received at the facility, they're provided a notification memo that explains the violence reduction strategy that we have. It goes over the prohibited violent acts. It discusses the immediate response, the enforcement, if one of those occurs, and that's the unit being locked down for 36 hours. And it also explains that we do have credible promises of help, some of the things that we're working on. And in addition to that, it's posted on our inmate information channel. So it's on a continuous loop that provides all that same information, again, so they can see what the prohibited violent acts are, how the response will be when one of those occurs. And then we also have the stuff about the credible, the third element of it, which is the credible promise of help.
Great. Now I'm going to ask you if you can actually share with us some before and after statistics to really show the success of this, and then we'll talk more about where we're going from here.
In 2014, to give a snapshot, we had 91 staff assaults in 2014. Last year, in 2018, we had 25. So we've had a 72.5% decrease in staff assaults when we look at 2014 to 2018.
Wow.
One of the other we look at key data indicators is assault misconducts overall. So that includes both staff and inmates. In 2014, we had 168 assault misconducts. In 2018, we had 99. So we had a 41% decrease in overall assault misconducts when we compared 2014 against 2018. And we've seen a decline each year that we've had the violence reduction strategies when it's been implemented. So just to in 2014, going back to staff assaults, there were 91. 2015, we had 70. 2016, we had 41. 2017, we had 35. And 2018, we had 25.
And your inmate population makeup is pretty much the same?
Correct.
Okay. So that really shows that, you know, the data is showing that whatever you're doing is working. Now, I understand that earlier this year, probably like maybe a couple of months ago, all of the superintendents were brought into central office and they were told to roll out the violence reduction initiative. So without going into too much detail, what can you tell me about that? I mean, obviously we don't want to share all of the tricks of our trade, but I find it interesting that now there's been a real formal movement to move ahead and roll this out. And also, so your statistics are through 2018, but you started this in 2014. We're 5 years later. Why 5 years later?
I think that one of the big things is that overall, that in 2016, when the statewide, when the secretary led the statewide committees and everybody looking at different approaches and a lot of the stuff with BetaGov and vetting out everything and seeing what was working and what wasn't working, the success and the reduction in the numbers over a sustained period that we were having gives way to get consistency throughout the department with the violence reduction strategy that we have at Forest and implementing on a consistent basis, because that's one of the keys to the, and really, and probably overcomplicated it in the discussion, but it's really a simple simple process that just simply involves the notification. That's the, one of the biggest elements. You have to tell them what the response is going to be and what the prohibited violent acts are. You have to be hyper-consistent with the enforcement of it, and you have to truly offer a credible promise of help. And those are really the three key elements. Once an institution's formed a committee, if you implement those three key elements, you should be able to produce the same results. In Washington State, we do, about every couple months, we do conference calls with Washington State Department of Corrections, who are implementing this strategy at three of their facilities now, and with the National Network for Safe Communities to continue to discuss any challenges that both states are having with their implementation of the strategy. And one of the things that is a consistent theme is sustainability. And so it's great that all the institutions are going to be doing this, because one of the things that happened in Boston and in the late 90s, they saw that 63% reduction in youth homicide, but they had one lieutenant at the Boston Police Department who was overseeing the procedure that was being implemented with the police department. He transferred to another department. So if you look at their trend lines in the early 2000s, it started going back up, and there was a connection there between sustainability. So one of the things is to make sure that there's a hyper-consistent procedure in place that everybody can follow with the same implementation. Physical plants are different at our facilities.
Right.
But the basic key elements of the strategy can be implemented at any, it's highly transferable, and it can be implemented at any facility. So
that's exactly what a point that I was going to raise is that, you know, we have some facilities that, you know, opened, you know, in the very late 1800s, some in the 1920s, some in the 40s. And so sometimes over the years, that's kind of limited, you know, like a statewide implementation of something. But this really isn't related to the physical structure, you know, itself. It is a concept, and it can be in place anywhere and hopefully be as successful.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, Superintendent, I really want to thank you for taking the time to explain this to us. And I know I've been seeing a lot of emails recently about, hey, under the Violence Reduction Initiative, this block has been locked down at this specific institution. And we're like, what is that? So I really wanted to also share that with, you know, our listeners. And I really appreciate you taking the time to get to the nitty gritty of this with us.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
And one thing I don't think I really got clarified in there, but with the strategy, because it is a group violence, and you asked a great question about there is pressure from inmates to not engage in that behavior, so there is some peer pressure not to repeat that behavior, but there's accountability, because if the group or a security threat group unit did encourage the violent act, if it was a hit that was called by a validated blood, STG blood member to assault another inmate, then not only is that perpetrator going to be held accountable through the misconduct process, but our procedure enables us to put restrictions on their close associates. Mm. So while they may not receive a misconduct and go into disciplinary custody status, we can take things, restrictions impose them that are meaningful, whether it's loss of commissary for 30 days, loss of TV privileges, loss of visits with the exception of legal visits for 30 days, loss of yard privileges, whatever, something that's meaningful, we can impose that restriction. So again, the goal is if a group can encourage the Prohibited Violent Act to occur, they can also discourage it. So there's group accountability if it is determined that it was a gang or group-related event.
Great. Sounds like great stuff. I'm excited that, you know, we're moving forward and can't wait to see the successful reduction that will show, hopefully, in the data in the next coming months and years. Again, thank you so much for giving us the nitty-gritty on this issue. And for our listeners, you can learn about this and all other types of programs related to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections at our website at www.cor.pa.gov. We'll see you next time.